Yes, the idea that Shakespeare wandered around with one of those sort of labeling machines and said, "This is Shakespeare's London. This is mine. This is mine." Hello and welcome to this somewhat damp episode of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. It's 1594 and the weather is terrible. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, which specialises in creating full-cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Today I'm talking with...
Laurie Johnson, Professor of English and Cultural Studies at the University of Southern Queensland.
About his book, Shakespeare's Lost Playhouse, 11 Days at Newington Butts. But before I begin the recording, here's a little roundup of what we're discussing, because a lot of dates, theatre companies, names and all sorts will be flying. One really useful online resource to help you navigate what we're talking about is Henslow as a blog. Philip Henslow was a theatrical impresario who wrote what's called his diary, but it's more a general ledger of takings for each day's show. Henslow as a blog puts out these theatrical notes as a mostly daily blog, and if you go to the site you can follow the performance days we're discussing and dance around the plays and the people involved. A link is in the episode data. Plus it's a great one to follow on Twitter, at Henslow as a blog. We're discussing The Playhouse, a commercial theatrical space converted around 1575. It's situated south of the River Thames, quite a way south in fact, hence that it has been largely dismissed over the years. It's a smaller space to the other soon-being-built theatres north of the river, the Theatre and the Curtain. It's converted at a time when playing companies, and there's a fair few, undergoing a never-ending rotation of names depending on their patron, and these playing companies are starting to grow and set up semi-permanent bases in London. For many years, the Playhouse at Newington Butts has little competition south of the river until the creation of the Rose Theatre. The year we're focusing on is 1594. And the Rose Theatre, the base for Philip Henslow's company, suffers a setback it can't immediately overcome, and the Playhouse at Newington Butts becomes their home for 11 days, along with another company. Why do these companies come together? Why at Newington Butts? Well, these are the questions that Professor Laurie Johnson answers in his book and in discussion now. So let's start with the entirely surprise attacking question that you're entirely not expecting. So as author of Shakespeare's Lost Playhouse, 11 Days at Newington Butts, why is your book titled Shakespeare's Lost Playhouse when it's barely about Shakespeare, and obviously we at Beyond Shakespeare take a dim view of anyone crowbarring the word Shakespeare into a title when the content doesn't necessarily connect very much to him? Is that a fair question?
It's a very fair question, and it's one that I continue to constantly feel myself needing to justify that very thing. It's one of those situations where, of course, a publisher insists that they must know more about Shakespeare, that the point of being in the Shakespeare Studies series is, of course, to say something new about Shakespeare, and yet really the purpose of the book and the vast majority of it is making the argument that in order to understand with much clearer vision the role and location of the Newington Butts Playhouse, we have to stop thinking about whether or not it's on the Shakespeare map to start with and to start looking elsewhere first. And then we might be able to answer the question about what's Shakespeare's relationship to it by the end of the book.
So let's start first principles. Tell me about Newington Butts, the playhouse. When was it built? Where does it fit within the world of theatre at the time?
One of the things I try and argue in the book is that based on a lot of evidence, which had tended to be disregarded and in fact outright dismissed for hundreds of years by theatre historians, There's a good chance that it was converted as a playhouse. I don't use the word built. I don't think anyone knows exactly when the structure itself was built. We lack the precise documentation to support that, but that it was converted into a playhouse from a previously existing structure in 1575, which of course is a year before Burbage's Theatre takes the gong for being supposedly the first purpose-built playhouse. It's situated a mile south of the Thames, along the Newington Causeway, called Newington Butts because of the location is right on the juncture of the causeway with the roads leading to south and southeast, Wallace one direction and Lambeth in another.
So we're talking about a converted space. Do we know what it was, or what its history as a site was prior to that, to by any great degree? I mean, how much do we know about the site before it became a theatre?
The only thing we know for certain is that there was a parcel of land, as it was called, that was leased to one particular gentleman who then leased a portion of it to Jeremy Savage, one of the leading men of Warwick's Men, the playing company of the Earl of Warwick. And on that space beforehand, that parcel of land, we know that there must have been some structure previously because we have a record then of a series of legal depositions made by the previous owner. The guy's name was Richard Hicks. He was the guy who owned the property, who then leased it to Savage, and whose son-in-law, Huntingbourne, tried to squeeze Savage out as they tried to evict Savage from the site. And they claim that on one particular day that he went to the house that's on the location there, house being the generic term at the time for any type of building, not necessarily a residential location. And he said that he was aware of there having been reparations made, and he wanted to go inside so that he might be able to determine the nature of them. Now, this, of course, suggests that he does not yet know that it's been changed into a playhouse, but from the outside of the building, he can't tell that it has been, which, to my way of thinking, suggests that whatever it was beforehand, it was sufficiently plain on the outside that without some kind of signage, it would have been impossible to tell the nature of the internal structure. But my gut feeling is that it wouldn't have been a significant internal change, that there must have been a significantly open space. So it might have been a commercial structure like a barn or some sort of storehouse beforehand.
So, in terms of, because we're going to get, or people are somewhat obsessed with the idea of purpose-built theatres, and how many theatres, purpose-built or otherwise, already sort of are about at this time when this theatre is being converted for use?
Well, we know that certainly some of the inns in and around London must have been being used. Certainly plays were being performed at some of the temple inns, but that, of course, they were already existing structures that had far many other uses than the playing spaces that would have been made available in them. The Red Lion structure that we know existed in 1567, but possibly only for a very short time, that was being custom built for a production of Castle of Perseverance. Yes, I could see you. Now we're
Oh,
outside
my eyes lit up for
the realm of Shakespeare, well and truly, that's for
that.
sure. That's the only one that we really know of as a potential prior candidate for the first of the Elizabethan playhouses, but it seemed to have been a very short-lived venture, and it was possibly a conversion as well. And so the question of purpose built, I think, becomes the key as to why I would say that I don't want to suggest that there's any other candidate than the theatre for the mantle of first purpose-built amphitheatre-style playhouse. But certainly, at least in the Red Lion and in the Newington Butt structure, which I call the playhouse for reasons I can explain in a moment. Apart from those two, we don't know of any others that necessarily had been around. There's no documentary evidence to suggest that there are any other structures that have been developed in around London at that stage.
Who were playing there during its lifetime? How complicated does that get?
It gets a little bit complicated because there's a significant gap, the better part of a decade, in which we don't have any specific documentary evidence of who was playing there, just that somebody was. Because we have Privy Council records telling the justices of the peace in Surrey to please get along to that playhouse there and find out who it is that's playing there in contravention of our ban, usually during a plague closure, for example, and kick them out. please. And of course, in those particular documents, we don't have mentions of companies. But I've been doing a little bit of work around the records of early English drama, trying to find out where are the gaps in the record that could suggest who are the available candidates at any given moment. So I've got a piece coming out in early theatre very soon in which I propose a possible solution to the company that were not named in Privy Council records in 1586, but having gone through the touring records and records of various companies performing in and around London and elsewhere, I think there's really only one candidate, and that's the Earl of Leicester's men. So what we have is Warwick's men playing there in 1575 through to about 1580, at which point Savage seems to have been evicted. Warwick's men, we know at around that same time, transform into Oxford's men. They change patron. And the surviving members, particularly John and Lawrence Dutton, are named in association with a number of activities still around London at that moment, including a riot that they possibly caused at the theatre in Shoreditch. And that, to me, suggests that the Oxford men probably were hanging on at Newington Butts Playhouse at around that time. Then 1586, I think we do have a record of someone playing there, and I think it's Leicester's men, based on the evidence I've got for that. Around 1590, we know that Lord Strang's men, or Strange's men, however you'd like to pronounce it, performed there because we have the series of documents relating to their petition to be allowed to go back to the Rose after the Privy Council had ordered them to play 3 days at Newington Butts. What that 3 days means, some people have conjectured it means 3 days a week for however long they were ordered to stay away from the Rose. I don't really have a sense of that, but we do know, therefore, that Strang's men performed at Newington Butts at that time. And then in 1594, we have the potential Shakespeare connection, of course, being that Philip Henslow records 11 days in which performances are staged at Newington Butts by the Lord Admiral's men and the Lord Chamberlain's men.
Over those sort of 20 years leading up to the focus on your book, how many playing companies are there about? Or how many develop over that period of time? Because they obviously change patrons. They need patrons to be able to get permissions to perform.
That's right. And it's actually one of the big problems we have in what's now kind of being shaped as what's called company study. Sally Beth McLean is sort of one of the vanguard scholars working in this field, where a particular group of players might have multiple patrons over a course of a period. Do we refer to them as a single company, having just referred to various patrons, or do we deal with each patronized entity as a separate company in its own right? And so how we handle that conversation tends to get quite slippery, and I wrap myself in a bit of a circle in the book trying to account for the possible connections between the various company groupings, including a number of crossover groupings that we know where Strang's men and the Admiral's men certainly performed in various combinations in the late 1580s and early 1590s. So we have Edward Allen, for example, the great Admiral's men player, performing on tour with a series of players under the patronage of Lord Strang. And yet he's identified in the documentation while being a member of that company. He's still called an Admiral's man. And so even the constitution of companies gets a little complex.
Such and such is on loan from from somewhere else.
I don't think it's so much loan as combinations forming in and of themselves, and it just depends on what piece of paper or what license each particular actor happens to have that he calls upon as his primary source. And the Admiral, of course, being more prominent than Strang would have been for Allen, the more important piece of documentation for him to have kept on his person throughout.
Oh, I see. So it might be a case of it makes it easier to perform if, depending where you are, to be able to say, well, we've got this patron. Which one do you prefer?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Well, we've got this odd situation around the theatre where people aren't always sure necessarily. Scholars have also tied themselves in knots trying to figure out from the documentary record which companies performed at the theatre. There is a sort of standard narrative that Burbage was attached to Shakespeare and Shakespeare and was attached to Burbage. And since the Burbage Theatre is the one in Shoreditch, then Shakespeare must have been associated with the one in Shoreditch for his entire London career. And yet we know Burbage was certainly playing early. We know Shakespeare was certainly writing earlier. And we have records of James and then Richard Burbage themselves being associated with one or another patron over the course of their career. And then there is this moment when there is a riot in association with the theatre in 1580, and so we're talking long before any connection, potential connection to Shakespeare or even the younger Richard Burbage. This is in the time of James Burbage, and the theatre is identified in Privy Council documents, and Burbage is called to account for this. I use the term riot, but I think it was used more in terms of an affray, if you like, just a kind of a bob in the streets as a result of a couple of the players were identified as being responsible for some, I think from memory, a couple of members of the crowd were beaten, of the audience were beaten, and then a number of the members of the audience took after the men in responsible. And because it was associated with the theatre, Burbage was held to account, and a number of scholars think that form means that one of the players in question, Dutton, was therefore associated with Burbage at that time, and therefore that Oxford's men were playing at the theatre. My gut feeling is that, in fact, this was one of these moments when a rival company goes to create a problem at that location, precisely to try and get the entrepreneur, the owner, in a bit of hot water. So you have this rivalry, of course, between the theatre in Shoreditch and Newington Butts. At Newington Butts, they're separated by about 2 miles either side of the City of London. The Rose by Henslowe hasn't been built yet. It's developed in 1587 on Bankside. It's quite possibly from 1587 that we then get the moment at which Newington Butts Playhouse starts to become less viable as a location for regular company participation in and around London, because with the Rose on Bankside, it becomes much easier to get to. So I think Newington Butts Playhouse was a fairly viable operation from 75 through to 86, 87. But once the Rose gets in and gets established with London is able to get there very easily via the watermen across the rivers, then Newington Butts becomes less viable as a location, except maybe for pundits from Surrey.
What's the overall capacity of these spaces? I mean, that's presumably part of the economic viability question.
That's right. And it's precisely on that very basis that I had to come up with a kind of speculative figure as to what would have been the capacity of the Newington Butts Playhouse. We've got pretty reliable numbers based on a number of different kinds of studies for the Rose that put its capacity at least at around 2,000. My suspicion is that Newington Butts probably would have been around about half that size, equivalent to about something like the Blackfriars.
So let's go to the focus of your book. Tell us about the 11 days.
Well, I'll explain first of all why I call it the Playhouse. We have, for a long time, people have been preferring just to call it Newington Butts, but I think that's the name that's given to the location on which the property sits. But that there are a number of documents that suggest that it was called the Playhouse, capital P, just as the theatre was capital T theatre. And that I think my gut feeling is it was called the Playhouse first, and then Burbage said, "Well, I'll one up you by calling mine the theatre." Or it could have been the other way around. I'm quite happy to accept that Burbage's theatre might have been named first, even though the Playhouse was built, or at least made operational first, and then the Playhouse comes second. But we do have a lease document referring to it as a parcel of land now called the Playhouse. And that, to me, is fairly hard evidence that that's the name by which it was known when it was operating as a playhouse. Now, those 11 days, what we've got in 1594 is this wonderful little moment in Henslowe's records where he has very short, sharp stints at the Rose by a series of companies. We have Sussex's men, then Sussex's men with Queen's men. Previously, it had been Strang's men, who the bulk of whom would go on to form the Lord Chamberlain's men via a little detour, a short period where they're known as the Earl of Derby's men. Then there is a gap, and then we have an entry that says, "In the name of God, Amen, beginning at Newington, my Lord Admiral's and my Lord Chamberlain's men." Then we have a series of records, and then there's a line under one, after which we then get another series of records fairly continuously, which has takings for Henslowe that seem consistent with everything that follows when Lord Admiral's men are his chief company at the Rose. But those 11 entries, or 11 days worth of entries, sorry, there's only 10 entries. There's one day, which just happens to be the day on which Rodrigo Lopez was executed. So I think that's why it was a down day. They knew they wouldn't be able to draw a crowd with a major execution going on.
I was going to ask earlier, but we'll come back to it. Is the nature of entertainment generally at the time? Of course, that's one of them.
That's exactly right. Interestingly, the play that was performed at Newington Butts the day after the execution was The Jew of Malta, and Lopez was being executed notoriously as a Jew, even though it was never proven that he was. I think there's a relationship between those two. But anyway, so we have these 10 records spanning 11 days from the 3rd to the 13th of June, 1594, that belong to Newington Butts, because those 10 entries have very low receipt return rates for Henslowe. My gut feeling is it's not just because the venue wasn't pulling the same crowd that he could get at the Rose, but because the arrangement he had with the owner of the building meant that his cut was also much lower. Mm. Now, of course, the question often people ask is, why would they have gone to Newington Butts? So a large chunk of my book was, first of all, proving that the venue was viable, but secondly, that there was a reason for both companies to have to go to Newington Butts and not perform elsewhere at that moment. What I found was that their significant record of floods sweeping through London for the period from April through to about September, and that the dates we have for the peak flood incidents happen to coincide very clearly with periods of activity and non-activity in Henslowe's records. And that to me, this gives a very clear indication as to why Admiral's men would have vacated the Rose if the building's been inundated by the tidal flood on the south side of the Thames there. Then it would be inoperable. But after a period, they realised this isn't going to work. We can't wait until the building is made viable again. We have to be able to continue performing. And so they decide to head on down to Newington Butts. People could say to me, but surely Newington Butts is in the same floodplain, Laurie. Yes, it is, except that geological surveys have long shown that there were three high points on the south side of the Thames in that floodplain area, and one of them is the Newington Butts juncture. And historically, there are records telling us that that was one of the places that never got inundated during any of the major floods during the previous couple of hundred years.
Is it also a case of sort of general routes of where people who are avoiding the floods might travel past? Would it
Absolutely.
Actually make it more attractive?
That's right. The causeway itself, in fact, was one of those dry points. There are continuous records of floods sweeping through Lambeth from the river near Westminster on the other side, and yet coming up against the causeway and then not flooding on the other side. There might be some seepage in from other parts of the Thames up near the Isle of Dogs and so on, heading back down towards the marshes. But on either side, the Newington Causeway was invariably flood-free. And this is because it was built on one of the high Roman causeways. So it had been in existence for quite a long time and then just kept being redeveloped by various generations of Brits to make use of that the foundations that the Romans had provided there.
So they vacate and head to Newington.
Now, I've got no doubt that crowds would have been smaller, not just because Newington Butts, as some people think, was a less popular location, but at least because the place is flooding. A lot of people might not necessarily think, my fields are flooded, I'll go to the theatre instead today. So I do think there was some struggle to get audiences through the door, but nevertheless, they still pulled a bit of money.
Wet summers are always difficult.
That's right.
You know, even in indoor theatres, getting a crowd, if it's raining out, people
That's
tend
right.
to, unless they've booked ahead, which they wouldn't have done. So, you know, the incentive to stay at home is great.
What is interesting, of course, is that we get two performances of Jew of Malta, the most popular play of its time. But interestingly, we also get on that first day after the execution of Lopez, the worst ever take for the Jew of Malta, which I think says something about what the audiences might have had a taste for following the execution of a real Jew. Do they want to go and see a fake Jew with a fake nose in a fake cauldron, having seen the real thing the day before?
The trap that producers sometimes go for, well, this is happening in the world today, so I will want to go and see a stage version of it, or something similar, and actually massively misjudging what the audience actually wants. Yes,
I think that's what happens, yeah.
I've been there. what other plays were playing that we know of, or we have, or we don't have, or
what else was performed at Newington Butts? Was we actually have the early Hamlet being performed there. We have Taming of a Shrew, and we have Titus Andronicus. a new play. And this is what I find really interesting, is that if it was just a throwaway venture, try and salvage a bit of money, I think nevertheless the company, Admiral's Men, goes there with intention to try and still keep to a schedule that they'd already planned out, a repertory sequence into which they've got to plug some Chamberlain's Men plays just because suddenly they're both playing at the same venue. I think there's some kind of combination that's going on there. And I've got a theory about that to do with cast sizes. The plays that we have performed at Newington Butts, for which we do have cast lists, all are large cast plays. And I think that suggests that this is a moment when the companies decide they'll agree to play in combination rather than alternation. But we have this new play, Bellandon, which unfortunately is also a lost play.
Yes.
And so what they would have been tapping into by staging Bellandon, it's mostly speculative. And I've got a few ideas as to what that could have involved. But we also have Cutlack, the play of Cutlack. And then again, we have to ask ourselves which story of Cutlack is being invoked here. One of the first plays, in fact, the first play performed in that repertory sequence, is Hester and Ahasuerus, another lost play, but about which we know the content fairly strongly. It's clearly from the Book of Esther. But a number of people have written about why would the companies be performing a biblical story at that moment? What's going on with that? I think there's more to do with not so much the biblical content as there is to do with some topical material that one might associate with the story of Hester or Esther, an inheritance of power that passes to a female recipient, and so on. I think there's some stuff around the death of the Earl of Derby at that moment, and a question as to whether he was poisoned, and the claim that was made on his titles by his wife and daughters against his brother, who wanted, of course, the Derby name for his own.
I'm just counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That seems to be very close to a full count. Have we
Cool.
Was there anything else that was performed there?
No, that'd be it, because Jew was performed twice
Yeah.
and Titus was performed twice from memory.
Titus was twice. How long did they? Was this the entirety of their or these two companies' stay at Newington Butts, or is that just where we have the records of their stay?
My gut feeling is it's the entirety, simply because the line that Henslowe draws between the 13th and the following section, I believe from memory, is the 14th. So I think we've got Admiral's Men performing back at the Rose within a day of the end of the repertory sequence. Things must have dried out enough, I'd say, for them to be able to go back and safely use that venue. However, I do leave a little bit of a speculation open at the end of the book to suggest that there's nothing to say that Chamberlain's Men didn't go back to the Rose with them initially, and that the playing combination then continued for a short time at the Rose before Chamberlain's Men then go off touring again. We have a record of them in Marlborough within a month or so. So we know at some point they did go back on the road.
Well, there's a certain logic. If you have vaguely rehearsed together and you've got some plays going, you don't necessarily want to tear that apart straight away. You want a few weeks to get yourself combobulated, as it were.
I think it also does help that Alan, for example, the leading Admiral's Men, had been performing with Strang's Men only a couple of years earlier on tour. In fact, sorry, only the previous year. It was 1593 he toured with them, and 1594 the two companies are at Newington Butts. And I suspect when we get Sussex's Men and Queen's Men performing under those names at the Rose, just before we get Admiral's Men and Chamberlain's Men performing down the road, that there are some of the players are involved in that Sussex's Men, Queen's Men combination. And so that's where we talk about discrete companies no longer being something we can talk about with any certainty at this moment. I do think we get similar combinations of performers bleeding from one company to another before they settle down by the end of 1594 to form the Admiral and Chamberlain's Men, who then perform at court quite regularly over the following 6 years.
I think it's been said by I forget who, but saying a theatre company's only got about 10 years before it needs to reinvent itself and shuffle out all the players around, especially at a time when people are much more likely to die.
That's right. And in fact, that's about the life of the Queen's Men. They were formed in 83, and they seem to have fallen out of favour by 1590, but there's enough evidence of them still performing for a few more years before they finally decide that it's no longer viable to continue performing.
Yeah, these playing companies, their repertoire being of a larger cast size, and we're talking a period when the cast sizes are noticeably nudging up. and the spaces that they might need changing. I mean, is there a logical progression to that, or is there just a sort of sense?
There's a number of people working on it at this very moment, in fact, and I keep dabbling in it from time to time myself, given the work I'm doing, but I haven't got a clear sense quite yet. I do think the 1594 large car size moment seems to be one of those steps, as if to say for the companies, having tried it at Newington Butts, a relatively small building, that it didn't work there, and it makes them more aware that they need larger spaces. And that's why the push comes to get the Globe as a larger building and the Fortune and so on, so we get these larger spaces developing in response to that. But it's a pet theory rather than something I can demonstrate with any kind of clear pattern. The Dublin cast actually are a significant component of that in the various versions we've got of the plays that for which we do have the quarto and then folio publications, in the case of Shakespeare, but quarto in the case of Jew of Malta, for example. We do have, and I look into this in the book, for the versions that might be attributed to a 1594 version, we get more stage directions that indicate more people needed. So there's far more attendants and lords and so on entering the stage, or boys also entering the stage.
We have reached the end of those 11 days. What happens to Newington Butts after that?
There's a strong suspicion that actually that's it. We get in September... The fellow who had been leasing the place, we don't know exactly what happened to him, but he doesn't renew the lease. A fellow by the name of Paul Buck then renews the lease and is given very clear directions by the dean and chapter of Canterbury that he must convert it to some other use, and that this is to be done by September. And given that he then gets the lease authorised the following year, it becomes very clear in my mind that he does, in fact, convert the building to some other use by September. So it's a very strong suspicion, I think, that once the Admiral's and Chamberlain's men vacate the building in the middle of 1594, that that's it. There are no more performances at that point, from beyond that point.
That's rather sad. A last hurrah in a time of emergency.
And I think without the Huntingbourne connection, the owner by that stage had lost the will to try and draw any kind of regular income out of the building being used as a commercial playing venue. My gut feeling is that it got converted to tenements almost immediately. Some people think that they were built on the site later. I think the conversion happened at that moment. That's it for Newington Butts, yes.
What happens to these two playing companies after they leave?
Well, Admiral's men go on to play for quite a long time thereafter at the Rose. Henslow's diary from 1594 onwards, at least until the end of the century, is pretty much a blow-by-blow description of every performance ever performed by the Lord Admiral's men, except when they're performing at court or occasionally on tour, and only very occasionally during, for example, closures. Chamberlain's men go on to Marlborough and a tour, and then around October, December, we start getting documentation where the Lord Chamberlain starts requesting the Lord Mayor to allow them to use Gray's Inn and to perform in London. And then by 1595, we have them being paid for a performance at court, and Burbage and Shakespeare's names are both on the recipients list, which suggests at that moment that they've definitely shacked up at the theatre, where they perform primarily for the following 3 years until the company loses the lease on the theatre, and the rest is the Shakespeare story. Shakespeare's Lost Playhouse, 11 Days at Newington Butts, by me, Laurie Johnson, was released by Routledge earlier this year, 2018. It, I hope, provides a significant intervention into a bunch of ongoing debates about, among other things, the companies, the playhouses, why and when they emerged in and around London, through the lens of a site that, in fact, scholarship had been preferring to ignore for 200 years, and quite bitterly so at times. I take on the doubters and naysayers and explain why it's worth looking at that site, if for no other reason than it gets us out of London, out of Shakespeare's London, as it's supposedly known, and to looking at the periphery and to understand what was going on at the so-called margins, to understand that far more complex relationship.
And Shakespeare's Lost Playhouse 11 Days at Newington Butts, is available now. And remember that there's a selection of ways you can get this work, not only buying a physical copy, but downloadable versions are available as well. You can even rent it for a short period of time. There are also, I believe, things called libraries. And I'll be rejoining Laurie Johnson for some more discussion in a moment. I should mention that you can support the Beyond Shakespeare podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. If you want to hear full cast audio adaptations of early English drama, early modern drama, then just by giving $1 a month, or for my UK listeners, that's currently about 77p, though exchange rates vary, you can get early access to new audio, tickets to live shows, and more. More importantly, depending on what you give, you get voting rights to choose our next season for us. The next poll opens in December to decide our summer season, so get pledging and help decide what we do next. The spring season has already been decided. We are doing Mariam, Queen of Jewry, The Life and Death of Jack Straw, Gamma Gurton's Needle, and Jack Juggler. What else do we do? At the moment, beyond the full cast audio stuff, we workshop future productions and release the recordings. Our exploring work started with the Chester plays in 2013, and we've just started recording again. I've got 3 Chester plays and 2 John Bale plays awaiting edit at this moment. These are primarily resources for future practitioners, so they're relatively simple reads through with some discussion, but it's all part of sharing material, whatever the quality, with the world. All of this audio exists in our Beyond Shakespeare podcast archive. And now for some more discussion with Professor Laurie Johnson. These are sections of the interview where we go over some tangents, entertainments of the period, more on archery, and other odds and ends. We mentioned Castle of Severance. I can't let you not elucidate on that. You brought it up earlier in relation to
the Red Lion.
Red Lion. Yeah.
So we have this record of the building being constructed at the Red Lion property in 1567 for a performance. And there's a fairly clear description of what the structure was like, because we have a legal, once again, thanks to the litigation procedures at the time. John Brain, actually, who would later go on to be one of the people involved in the construction of the theatre with Burbage, is the man who's mounting a case against one of the men involved in building the scaffolds. It seems he didn't do a very good job, which partly might explain why the venture was short-lived. They just decided to tear it down rather than risk life and limb.
Would the scaffold, are we referring to, it's always a little difficult to tell, are we thinking audience seating or standing area, or are we talking stage?
Thank you, that's exactly where I was heading. Precisely what they mean by that, in fact, has been the subject of speculation, but we do have a very clear description as well that the central element of the playing space was to involve a large central turret feature, hence the belief that it was for the Castle of Perseverance, that the audience would be seated around the castle itself and then watching the action unfold in various open spaces in front of them.
It's a fascinating play to choose.
That's right.
I mean, it would make very good event theatre if you can cast, you can get a full cast size for it. I've always wanted to do it with, you know, cast of thousands and a budget of millions.
Yeah. Whereas I suspect this was a very concentrated production, shall we suspect, where most of the money seemed to be going on the site rather than on the production itself.
Apart from that description and that, did that go any further that we know of?
No, it all got tied up in legal wrangling for some time, and there seems to be no evidence whatsoever of the site ever having been used again for playing thereafter. My gut feeling is that the Red Lion structure is a kind of in-between moment between the companies bugging in, bugging out quite regularly on the road, and a drift towards a desire to build something with a more purposeful, longer-term usability.
I briefly mentioned other entertainments earlier. What other entertainments are there out there?
Well, we have certainly the bear baiting and the animal baiting on Bankside. Even though the Rose itself wasn't built till 87, certainly there were baiting arenas possibly for a good 20 years before that, maybe even slightly more. We have the copper plate map of London, which seems to date to the 1560s, that contains a picture of the bear baiting and the bull baiting on the bank side. So we know that those structures were there for quite some time. We also have St George's Fields, just to the north of Newington Butts, which was a popular location for hunting, for riding, for various ball sports, and of course for the fairs. So the Southwark Fair was just up the road as well.
I mean, obviously there's drinking.
And that's where the inns are really useful as well. And, of course, the brothels, all on the outskirts of London. That's one of the reasons why I think most of the large purpose-built or at least converted structures appear on the outskirts of London. I think they're there to attach themselves to a whole bunch of other pastimes that people are partaking of that give them grounds to leave Bishopsgate to the north or cross the river to the south. And in Shoreditch to the north, we've got the markets and Spitalfields nearby, which was a popular location for, among other things, archery. Now, this is also where I've got a pet theory that I'm developing at the moment. I've got a publication coming out very soon in a book by Lisa Hopkins and Bill Angus on reading the road in early modern London, in which I suggest that all of the early playhouses seem to have been located relatively close to an archery butts. And of course, Newington Butts definitely had an archery butts in its vicinity, and I've found some sufficient evidence in the Privy Council records to suggest that it was directly across the sewer from the playhouse. Mm. This is important not just because archery could be understood as a pastime, but because it was mandated.
Yes.
That every man from the age of 17 had to at least once every fortnight get himself to an archery butts and shoot the arrows and keep in practice. And I think that gives the entrepreneurs in charge of the playhouse a significant reason to want to build within the vicinity of archery butts. There is some work that I'm following at the moment, and I might buy into it at some stage, around the extent to which some of the early stages were built in dimensions that accord with fencing, and that they also seem to be spaces that were in the vicinity of archery butts. And so I think there's something going on there around the type of martial combat that one could stage, knowing that archery itself would be particularly dangerous to stage in a closed space. But having said that, I do think there's something to be said for, at least for a short period of time, some of the open theatres in the vicinity of archery butts quite happily staging a volley of arrows out of the theatre in question into the nearby archery butts, so long as they shouted their volley warning beforehand. Mm. Of course, at that time, given the royal mandate for archery, so long as a man called out his warning in advance, he could not be prosecuted if his an errant arrow happened to cause loss of life or limb.
If only that applied to golf as well.
That's exactly right. Recent events quite yes. Bringing that into the spotlight. There's some lovely
quite.
Stuff that I could have gone into, but it was going to be rather convoluted to try and explain it to anyone who hasn't actually read some of the background material around Fields' Woman is a Weathercock, in which one of the characters says, "Oh, Newington conceit," as Abraham Ninny makes a joke. And it's long been thought that that was a reference to the playhouse and how it had become a joke in the minds of the people. But I spend an entire chapter ripping that idea to shreds. And that involves a fair chunk of analysis of what that line is doing in the field play at that moment. But I enjoyed that part of the book, and it's the part of the book that's the least about Shakespeare, but it would have been rather a difficult tell in an interview situation.
Well, you know, one day when we get round to doing it, we can have a lengthy discussion about...
Absolutely, when you do that play, absolutely.
And that's it for this week. Do go out and buy, either physical or download or even rent, Shakespeare's Lost Playhouse to find out more about this area. Next week we'll be releasing something. Probably a couple of things, but I don't know what yet. If you can support the work, then do pledge something today. That's www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. And remember to keep warm and dry, because the weather out is terrible.